let's see, is taking data within the next year, we might hope for some sort of discovery. And a lot of the attention, rightly, has been focused on sort of traditional prompt signals, things like scorched arduinos that are produced with a large cross-section that give you jets and missing ET. Things with big cross-sections are interesting to look at in the early data. But another thing that's interesting to look at in early data are particles with long lifetimes, because they also offer the prospect of an early discovery, because the standard model typically doesn't tend to give you many events that fake these, so they could potentially be very clean. Okay, so when I say long lifetimes, what kind of scale do I mean? Here's a picture of the inner detector at Atlas. So this is the tracking chamber. You can see the innermost part of it are pixel detectors near the beamline. They're sort of located a centimeter away from the beamline. And the outer parts of this tracking chamber are on the order of 2 meters. If you take a broader view of the entire Atlas detector, it's more on the order of 10 meters in size. So the interesting range of lifetimes range from things that the pixel detector can pick up, which are something on the order of tens to hundreds of microns, all the way to decays that are happening out at distances of order 10 meters. And just as a rule of thumb, you can remember that a nanosecond is about a foot. So,
it's a very American set of units.
It is, yeah. Yes. But 0.3 meters doesn't sound as nice as 1 foot. So, okay. So some examples of things that might give you long lifetimes, I'll mostly be talking about gauge mediation, but there's a whole range of things that could do this, and mostly it's just things where you have a higher dimension operator, and the scale that's suppressing it is not too far above the TEV scale, so that things still decay within your detector. So just as some examples, in gauge mediation, we have a supersymmetry breaking scale, F, and the lifetime goes like m to the fifth over F squared. The square root of F is something with dimensions of energy. So just to plug in some numbers and give you a sense of what that means, you get lifetimes C tau on the order of 0.1 millimeters if the mass scale of the particle that's decaying is about 100 GeV, and the Suzy breaking scale is of order 100 TeV. Another thing that could do this would be an axino. In that case, you're suppressed by an axion decay constant, and you get, well, it's a different scaling. It's m cubed over f axion squared, but you also have some small couplings in front. And what that means is that you can get distances of order 10 millimeters, again, if the mass of the thing that's decaying is about 100 GeV, and the axion decay constant now is of the order of 1,000 TeV. So something like an axino associated with a QCD axion wouldn't work for this because you would expect the decay constant to be bigger, but you can imagine lots of scenarios where you have some U1 that's broken not too far above the TeV scale and it can give you this decay. Another thing which a lot of you are familiar with is kinetic mixing. If you have something like our lightest supersymmetric particle decaying into a particle in some dark sector that couples by kinetic mixing of some U1 in the dark sector with the photon, this can easily give you long lifetimes, for instance, 0.1 millimeters, again, for a mass of 100 GeV, and with this mixing parameter epsilon, 10 to the minus 6. This one is sort of, again, a higher dimension operator in disguise, because usually if it's just a renormalizable coupling, you'll induce this with loops, and epsilon will be something like 10 to the minus 3. So to get this sort of suppression, you really need this to be something more like an S-parameter type operator. So sort of the rule of thumb is that anytime you have these higher dimension operators and the scales that are suppressing them are sort of order hundreds to thousands of TeV, you might expect things happening with long lifetime decays. Another example is asymmetric dark matter. Okay, so the specific case that I'll be talking about is gauge mediation. If there's supersymmetry at the TeV scale, then obviously one of the most important questions is how it's mediated to the standard model. And gauge mediation is one appealing answer, in particular because it solves the flavor problem, which is difficult to do in gravity mediation scenarios. So I won't be doing any model building in this talk. I'll just be assuming that there's something like gauge mediation and telling you what it would look like at the LHC, and maybe a little bit at the Tevatron. So the key feature of the phenomenology of gauge mediation is that you have some supersymmetry breaking scale, and the gravitino mass is ordered that scale over the Planck scale. So in particular, it tends to be light. So gauge mediation can dominate over gravity mediation as long as the scale is not too big, something like below 10 to the 6 TeV. And the lowest that the scale could be is something like 10 TeV. If it were lower, you would wonder why we haven't already seen the superponents. So in general, this is the scenario we'll be talking about. The gravitino mass is sort of ranging in the scenario between an EV and a GEV. At the upper end of this range, the lifetime is too long for, well, I'll get to the lifetime in a bit, but it would be too long to see. So mostly I'm focused more on the lower end of this range, something like 10 TeV to 1,000 TeV. So the NLSP is the word I'll be using for the lightest MSSM particle, which then decays down to the gravitino at the end of the decay chain. And this decay is really what drives the phenomenology and makes it distinctive from other supersymmetry scenarios. So the basic phenomenology here is that you get these decays of the NLSP to the gravitino. Traditionally, people have focused on a sort of very minimal setup, and they've assumed that this NLSP is either a Beano or a Stau, which gives you very characteristic phenomenology. And that's what most experimentalists still think of when you say gauge mediation to them. They think of these very particular signals. But there's a much wider range of signals to think about. These traditional signals give you things like if you have a Beano and it has a long lifetime, then you get photons. But the photons didn't come from the interaction point, so they're called non-pointing photons. And to some extent, the calorimeters can measure that they're non-pointing, and I'll elaborate on that in a bit. So that was worked out in a lot of detail by Kawagoe and collaborators several years ago. And there's some ATLAS analyses that have been planned based on this. If you have something like a Stau, then you get a long-lived Stau, which is a charged particle, so you get highly ionizing tracks. And this falls in the general category of things that people call CHAMPs, charged massive particles, or sometimes they call them HSCPs, heavy stable charged particles. And that's a pretty standard search mode by now. It's been searched for at CDF and D0. It will be searched for at CMS and ATLAS. In the case that we have a neutral particle, though, you don't get those characteristic cracks, so you have to look for the photons that come from the decay. And photons are not ideal because they're not charged. They don't interact much with matter until they hit the calorimeter and they dump their energy there. And it's a little bit hard to figure out where they came from. So what I'll be emphasizing is that in the same sorts of scenarios where you get photons, you also tend in much of the parameter space to get lots of Zs and Higgses coming out of these decays. So you have a neutral particle that can decay to a Z or a Higgs plus a gravitino, but then the Z or the Higgs can decay to charged particles. And the fact that they decay to charged particles makes them much more visible and gives you many more handles on the kinematics and how to reconstruct the underlying physics. Okay, so why would you go beyond this minimal gauge mediation scenario that people traditionally studied that gave you Beanos or Staus at the bottom of the spectrum? One theoretical motivation is that there are many reasons to want a Higgs-Zeno at the bottom of the spectrum. If you have gauge mediation, you typically have some amount of fine-tuning because the colored particles couple to with more strength and have larger Casimirs, so they couple more to the messengers that feel Susie breaking, and they tend to pick up bigger masses. So a traditional gauge mediation spectrum has heavy squarks, heavy gluinos, and things with only electroweak charges are much lighter. So it tends to be a bit tuned. But you can imagine a more general scenario that's less tuned. This was first pointed out by Kaustu Bagasha and Michael Grasser more than 10 years ago. And the basic explanation of why this helps is that at large tan beta, you need some approximate relation like this to have supersymmetry breaking. So mu, the thing that determines the Higgs-Zeno mass, is related to mz and mhup. MHup is determined by sort of a fundamental contribution from gauge mediation, which, because it has weak charges, is proportional to the weak coupling constant, and it's related to the mass and the number of messenger particles that have weak charges. But there's also a correction to this that comes from the stop loops, which is the usual thing that drives the Higgs and the renormalization group running. And that depends on the strong coupling constant and the number of messengers that have QCD charge. So in minimal gauge mediation, all the messengers came in fives and five bars of SU5, so you had the same number of doublets, of weak doublets and QCD triplets, and these contributions were related in a particular way that ends up being tuned. If you allow a more general model where you don't have the same spectrum of messengers, or maybe the masses are split between the things that have QCD charges and the things that don't, you can accommodate some cancellation in this relationship. That means that you can achieve electroweak symmetry breaking with a small value of mu, which wasn't possible in the minimal setup. So that allows you to put Higgs-Zenos at the bottom of the spectrum, and if you do that, then you can find spectra that are less fine-tuned. And these authors, Chung, Fitzpatrick, and Shi, found that if you look at sort of general renormalizable scenarios for gauge mediation, it's quite common to find a Higgs-Zeno at the bottom of the spectrum. Another reason that you might want this is the gauge mediation traditionally has a problem called the mu-b-mu problem, which is that there's this parameter b-mu, which tends to be much larger than mu if you just compute it naively in a lot of scenarios. And again, if you look at the conditions for electroweak symmetry breaking, this is a difficulty for gauge mediation. One way out of this, though, is that It's really only a difficulty if you assume that MH down and MH up are sort of comparable. But if you allow yourself to take MH down to be enhanced by this large factor of tan beta, then you can find solutions to these electroweak symmetry breaking conditions that have sort of a hierarchy of these soft terms, where B mu is much bigger than U squared, MH down squared is much bigger than B mu. This was pointed out by Chaki and company a couple of years ago. And so again, in that sort of spectrum, you solve the mu-B mu problem, you understand electroweak symmetry breaking better within the framework of gauge mediation, and it tends to produce a small mu, so light Higgsinos. So there are several theoretical reasons to think that we might want to consider this. More generally, you can just say gauge mediation can be a very general class of things. This was elaborated by Mead, Seiberg, and Shi a couple of years ago. All you really need for gauge mediation is some sector that breaks supersymmetry, that has some global symmetries, which you weakly gauge with the standard model gauge couplings. Once you do that, you can compute all the Suzy breaking effects just in terms of correlation functions of the conserved currents for these global symmetries. And it turns out that almost every parameter in gauge mediation is independent of the others. So you can get pretty much any spectrum you want somewhere in parameter space. And in fact, it's not that hard to build simple models that cover this entire parameter space. So you have a separate mass for each of the gaugenos. So Beano, Weino, and Gluino all have different masses. Then you have independent masses for the scalars. So QU, DLE, all of these have different soft masses. And the Higgses are sort of outside this framework, but you need to add a little bit more to explain them. The only real constraints on all of these parameters are two sum rules. So basically, you could just count up every possible soft term and then subtract off these sum rules. So pretty much everything is independent. So in general, any MSSM particle can be the NLSP somewhere in parameter space of gauge mediation. And you can think about the phenomenology of all of these. If you had a Skork or Gluino at the bottom of the spectrum, if they're prompt, they just give you Judson missing ET, and it looks a lot like sort of traditional M. Sugra signatures that experimentalists know how to look for. If things are long-lived, then you get more interesting physics out of these Skorks or Gluinos. They'll hadronize, and they'll become what are called R-hadrons, and the phenomenology of that has been worked out in a lot of detail. One thing that motivated that was split supersymmetry, where you had long-lived Gluinos for a different reason. And in fact, there have already been searches for that at the LHC. So one of the things that they've done already is to look for events where you produce some colored particle, it interacts with your detector and stops somewhere, and then when the machine isn't operating, if it decays, they would get some sort of flash of energy in the calorimeter that's otherwise unexplained. And so that's a relatively easy thing to look for, and I think both Atlas and CMS have already reported some preliminary results on that. You could have sleptons at the bottom of the spectrum, and they're charged particles. They would leave tracks. Sneutrinos give you interesting phenomenology, but their decay isn't very interesting because they decay to a neutrino plus the gravitino, and both of those are invisible, so you don't see that decay. But there's been some interesting recent work on the phenomenology by Andre Katz and Brock Tweedy. But I'll be focusing on general neutralino NLSPs, possibly with chargenos nearby in the spectrum. And in that case, the things that you can get out of decays are photons, Zs, and Higgses. And which one you get basically depends on whether your neutralino is mostly Beano, mostly Higgsino, or mostly Weino. So you'll decay to photon, mostly if you're Beano. You'll decay to Z. Either if it's a Weino, it'll decay to transversely polarized Zs, or if it's Higgsino, it will decay to longitudinally polarized Zs. And if it's Higgsino, it will also decay to Higgses. And so all of these are fixed. All of these decay widths are proportional to one overall scale, which, as I said earlier, is the mass to the fifth divided by the Suzy breaking scale squared. And again, to put some numbers there, if that mass is 100 GeV and supersymmetry is broken at 100 TeV, the lifetime is about a tenth of a millimeter. So it's easy to get macroscopic lifetimes as long as the supersymmetry breaking scale is a bit above 100 TeV. This is pretty much just repeating what I just said. If you have Weinos, then the chargino and neutralino tend to be extremely degenerate. So one thing that can happen there is that the chargino will directly decay to a W plus the gravitino. if the lifetime of the decay to the gravitino is becoming long enough, that is, if the Susie breaking scale is becoming high enough, then this won't happen because you'll have a more prompt three-body decay of this down to the neutralino. So mostly, since I'm interested in long lifetimes, I won't be concentrating on this, but you can find some remarks on this scenario in the earlier paper that I wrote with Patrick and David. Okay. But mostly I'm interested in Higgsinos, which can decay to both Higgses and Zs. At large 10 beta, and as long as it's not so light that there's phase-space suppression, these happen 50-50. At small 10 beta, one or the other will dominate, and it depends on essentially on the sign of mu. And there's some other weirder scenarios you can get. Like, you can actually have the Chargino at the bottom of the spectrum, below a neutralino, which Graham Cribbs and company have worked on. But I won't be dealing with that. I'll be assuming that the soft masses for the gauginos are positive, in which case that doesn't happen. Okay, so the sorts of things you get if tan beta is, say, 20, you decay dominantly to Zs until you get to masses that are large enough where Z and Higgs becomes 50-50, and you can see that's happening somewhere at 300-ish GeV. So even fairly heavy things like 200 GeV still have enough base-space suppression that they tend to go to Z most of the time. The only scenario where you really dominantly have decays to Higgs is if tan beta is small and the sign of mu is negative. And in that case, again, Z can dominate over some region of fairly light masses where the phase-space suppression is too strong to go to Higgs. The Higgs in all of these plots is 115, I think. Okay, so I won't go into this in any detail, but this was the result of our first paper. This is sort of what the Tevatron has done and can do. The Tevatron is basically bounded scenarios where you have a Wino, or a Beano, or where you have a Wino, where the Wino is degenerate so that you get the decay to W from the charged Wino. And in those cases, these are the limits. The lightest charged thing, which is what you produce, which decays down to a Beano, has to be above 270 GeV. The Wino has to be above 135 GeV, and these only apply when the decays are pretty prompt. So these might apply up to a lifetime of around a nanosecond. They might break down a little bit before that. It depends on modeling of the detector that I don't know how to do very well. But in the prompt case, you can see there are limits, but they're not very strong. And for Higgsinos, there are actually no limits currently. We think they could put limits, but they haven't done it yet. So there's a lot of room. I mean, these things could be pretty light, and we could have not seen them yet. So one interesting difference between the LHC and the Tevatron is just that at the LHC you have more energy, so you tend to produce things more energetically, and you tend to get bigger boosts. This is just pure electroweak production of the Charginos, and you can see at the Tevatron you produce things with a Lorentz factor of maybe 1.5. At the LHC it's more often 3, 4, it can be even larger. So you can end up with things that are very boosted. You can end up with the K products of the Z and Higgs being sort of collimated, and that was worked out by Graham Cribbs and company. There's an interesting possibility of doing jet substructure analyses there. Okay, but now I want to move on to my main topic, which is delayed decays. So as I said, it's generic to have long lifetimes in gauge mediation. In fact, if you look at the whole parameter space, it's pretty common to have them happening outside the detector where you don't see them at all. But there's a range where they happen inside the detector. And it's not really theoretically preferred. Theoretically, I don't know a good reason to think that the Susie breaking scale is one place or another. It could be anywhere from 10 TeV to 10 to the 10 GeV, and I don't know what I should prefer. But phenomenologically, it's interesting to focus in on the region where the decays are happening at distances of order the size of the detector. So to give you some idea of where that is, here's a plot of contours of lifetime versus neutralino mass and the Susie breaking scale. You can see it's relatively independent of the mass of the thing you're producing. It's mostly just determined by the supersymmetry breaking scale, at least within some range of reasonable masses. And so Susie breaking scales from around 1,000 TeV to 10,000 TeV are roughly where you're seeing decays that are on the order of the detector size. So the shortest distances we'll really be able to go to are a bit below this. This is 1 millimeter, which happens at sort of 500 TeV-ish. We can actually probe down to something like 0.1 millimeters, so a couple hundred TeV. And the maximum that we think they can probe is something like 10 to the 4 TeV. So it's a range of something like 6 orders of magnitude in lifetime, which corresponds to 1.5, 2 orders of magnitude in supersymmetry breaking scale. Okay. So here's what the geometry of a detector looks like. I don't know if this is all completely legible. This is Atlas, so you have an inner detector, which we're using to refer to the parts where you have pixel detectors, you have silicon, and you can accurately measure vertices. Past that, you have what's called the TRT, the transition radiation tracker, which measures tracks, but only measures them in sort of one direction. So you know where they are in the R5 plane, which sort of cuts through the detector, but you don't know where they are along the Z-axis, which is the beamline direction. Outside that, you have your electromagnetic calorimeter, which is starting at a distance sort of 1.5 meters, and it extends out to about 2 meters. You have the H-cal going out a couple more meters, and then the muon system extends all the way out to 10 meters. At CMS, this is a bit more compressed because it's not as big. But this sort of sets the scale for where the interesting decays happen and which detector components you can use to look for them. And if you ask where these decays happen, if you just generate some events that are engaged mediation, what you find is that even out to quite long lifetimes, something like 4 meters, more of your decays are happening within the silicon layers than anywhere else. So you can really rely a lot on your inner detector, even for fairly long lifetimes. When you go to longer lifetimes, the muon system starts to win because it has this huge volume located at long distances. And you have all the other detector subsystems, the H-cal, the E-cal, where decays could happen, but it's usually a fairly small fraction. So you don't lose a lot if you focus on things that you can either measure well using the tracker or things that happen farther out in the muon system, which is useful because it turns out that those are the most useful detectors because the tracker and the muon system both are capable of telling you what direction things are going when they pass through it, whereas the calorimeters just give you sort of a total amount of energy and not a lot more information than that. So it's nice that we don't actually have to rely on the calorimeter as much.
What are the flexion channels
here? Most of what I have to say is pretty much independent of that because it's just focused on the last step of the decay. But it could be gluinos and squarks. I'll have some plots with reach of the first year data for gluinos or squarks. It could be just pure electric weak production, which within the first year you don't have a lot of sensitivity to, but there is a region of lifetime around a meter where you do. And then, of course, later on with more data, you're sensitive to electric weak production. Even if the squarks or gluinos are extremely heavy and they're not contributing a lot. So this is for producing a 250 GeV hexeno, just electroweak production. So whatever distribution of gamma factors you get is folded in. We played with several different scenarios and made plots like this, and it doesn't make a huge amount of difference. So there's not really any sort of kinematic regime where, say, the hadronic calorimeter is dominantly where decays are happening. So it's sort of just a geometric fact that this distribution is exponentially falling. So even if the lifetime is very long, you have sort of a flat distribution of where the decays happen geometrically. So a lot of them still happen in the inner regions even then. And the muon system just has a huge volume, which is why it sort of starts to take over at some point. So that statement that you can use the inner detector of the muon system is pretty robust and not too sensitive to the spectrum. The boost that's produced.
Logical, theoretical, experimental restriction of the Higgs signal mass?
Not really. I mean, so as I mentioned a couple of slides back, there's no current limit from the Tevatron on this particular scenario. And theoretically, I mean, you would hope that it's not too heavy because you would hope that the spectrum is sort of within reach, but there's not really a I don't know any sharp statements I can make about what range I expect it to be in.
Because I mean, the lightweight model, the theoretical, experimental, phenological restrictions on the Higgs mass.
Yes. I don't really know anything analogous there.
It's too bad.
I mean, I'm sure it can't be too light. If we thought about it, I'm sure there are limits that tell us it's not at 10 GeV, right? But even though the Tevatron hasn't published a limit that I can quote, I'm sure there's some lower bound, but I don't know exactly what it is. Something on the order of 100 GeV.
Did you think about the left foot itself?
A bit, but it's been a while, so I don't remember what the punchline was. I don't think there was anything very strong from LEP. I mean, I guess LEP tells you there shouldn't be charginos below about 100 GeV. So that tends to limit you.
Right.
But with hexenos, the neutral one can be split quite a bit from the charged one. So I think the lightest neutral Higgs anneal can be below 100 GeV in some part of parameter space. But then it wouldn't decay to Higgs anyway. So or it would barely decay to Z,
I don't
maybe.
Know
it would probably
how
mostly go to protons.
Charge searches are affected by decay into a neutrally known that has a long decay.
No, that's a good point.
They weren't that inclusive.
They might not, yeah. Okay. So here's the kind of decay I'm mostly interested in. You have some interaction that happens somewhere along the beamline. A bunch of stuff comes out. Maybe you made squarks and gluinos. Maybe you just made some heavier charginos that decayed down. But whatever happened, you have some tracks that come directly from the interaction point, so you can measure where it is. And then what happens is you make you make something that decays down to these lightest neutralinos. They have a long lifetime, so they propagate out. Maybe one of them gets away completely. One of them decays somewhere inside the detector. When it decays to a Z, which goes to E plus E minus, and a gravitino, which is invisible. So what you see is all the stuff that came directly from the interaction point, plus these two clusters of electromagnetic energy. And if the decay happens soon enough, you might see the tracks. But in general, if the decay is displaced, you won't, because the default tracking algorithms look for tracks that point back to the beamline. So in general, you'll tend to miss these tracks. Later on, you can dig them out. But initially, what you'll see are these two clusters of electromagnetic energy. And to some extent, the calorimeter is capable of measuring this angle, the theta direction, as you cross the calorimeter. And the interesting thing about a long lifetime is that this angle, the angle at which the particle is moving when it crosses the calorimeter, is not the same as the angle that it came from the interaction point. So whenever things are promptly produced, those are the same angle, and it doesn't really help you to measure it here. But in this case, it's useful because it's different information. And that's why long lifetimes sometimes can let you reconstruct kinematics that you would not otherwise be able to reconstruct if the decay happened promptly. But before I talk about reconstruction in detail, I just want to start with the first goal, which should be just discovering something, establishing that there is a signal there. So the first thing we ask before thinking about all the details of reconstruction is, what are the minimal requirements we would need to determine that a signal exists? And the idea here is that we use detector components that can point an object back. So that would be, for instance, tracks. Once you reconstruct a track, you can figure out where something came from. The muon system also has directional information. It has multiple layers, and you can see where things went across, and you can reconstruct where they were coming from. So we rely on the tracker and the muon system because they can point an object back. And then we use the inherent resolution of how well you can do that pointing to try to insist that things didn't come from the interaction point. So we try to demand at 5 sigma that you know that this thing is significantly displaced relative to something that came from a prompt decay. So here's a sketch of how you might do that. You have these two clusters of energy. Initially, you wouldn't find the tracks if they're very displaced. But if you go and dig into your tracking information, you can do it. And then if I draw lines back on these tracks, so here, this was the interaction point. This is the decay point. This RD is the radial distance between the interaction point and the decay point. And then there's another distance that's actually measurable. RD isn't really directly measurable. But if you extrapolate this track back, you can figure out what's the closest approach to the interaction point along its trajectory. And that's called the impact parameter, or the distance of closest approach. Another thing you measure, which we're not actually using at this point, is the time of the detector signal and the calorimeter. But that's another sort of consistency check that you can do. So something that comes from a decay like this is delayed for two reasons. One is that the path length along this to here is longer than the direct path length of a straight line. The other is that this first object that you made was massive, so it's moving more slowly than the speed of light. So these things tend to arrive later than you would expect them to arrive, and you can measure that. So the sort of cuts that we do, there's some basic geometric cuts. You look for these energy deposits within the central part of the calorimeter. In our simulation, we required that it decays before 800 millimeters, which basically means that there's some cutoff here beyond which you wouldn't get enough hits to really be able to tell what was happening. But if it decays before that, you'll get enough hits in the tracker that you can find this track. The objects should be well separated. They should have some minimal amount of energy. In early data, the trigger thresholds are pretty low for 2 photons, so they only need something like 20 GeV. And then depending on which part of the detector you want to use to try to extrapolate them back, we have different cuts. If they decay promptly enough to leave hits in the silicon, which we take to be 50 millimeters, then you can extrapolate back well enough that if the distance of a closest approach is greater than 0.05 millimeters, 50 microns, you know that they were significantly displaced. If the decay happens later, so that you can't use silicon information, you don't have as accurate a reconstruction, and the distance is something more like a centimeter. But once you measure these significant distance of closest approach for the tracks, you can see that this wasn't a prompt interaction like you get from most standard model physics. Okay, and this is something I'll get to a bit later. The other thing you can do is use the muon system. So here's a picture of the ATLAS muon system. You can see it starts at about 4.5 meters out and goes all the way out to 10 meters, so it's really big. Within that volume, there's sort of many different systems. There's this whole zoo of acronyms, MDTs, CSCs, RPCs, which are giving you measurements somewhere along the way. Some of them measure sort of only in one direction. Others measure in both. And for this study, we're really only using the central part of the muon system. So there are further things happening further out. I'm going to ignore them, but potentially they could also be used. So again, we have some set of cuts. We demand that something decays early enough that it goes through all the muon layers. We ask that it's contained within the central region. And there's also this important separation requirement, which basically means that at each of these layers, if the two tracks from the Z decay are too close together, you wouldn't resolve them. So we need a certain amount of separation between them. And we need some amount of PT to be able to trigger. And this is something important. The time delay between when it hits, let me see. If I remember correctly, it's this layer. The time delay between when it hits this layer and when it would have hit if it came directly from the interaction point has to be less than 6 nanoseconds. Otherwise, the electronics get confused. And they're not sure which bunch crossing to associate what they're seeing with. You only need this to happen for one of the two muons. So that sort of means that it can't have you can't have a trajectory where your neutralino sort of goes out too far and then decays at a wide enough angle that the extra path length is too big. But that's not really a huge problem. Another thing you can do with the muon system. So here I'm telling you if something decays before the muon layers, the muons will punch through everything else and they'll get out here. But another thing that could happen is that something can decay in the muon layers to jets. If it decayed earlier, the jets would just mostly deposit their energy in the calorimeter. But if the decay happens out here, the jets can go through some of these layers and you'll have many tracks happening. And you can see that there's a lot of activity in the muon system that doesn't look like a muon. It looks like way too much is going on. And the reason that this is useful is that there's actually a special trigger designed for that, which was invented because of Hidden Valley models. So this is something that Matt Strassler was really pushing. And ATLAS now has a couple of these Hidden Valley triggers. This is one of them. It looks for three regions of interest in the muon system, which basically means sort of three separate tracks. And it has to decay before the 7-meter mark, which means that it goes through this layer and this layer, but it doesn't have to go through the first layer. So what this does is it extends our reach to things that decay sort of within this volume beyond the H-cal before the middle of the muon system. And if we put all of this together, we can make some contours. It's hard to understand what the right backgrounds are for this, because there really isn't any standard model process that gives you something that looks like these events. So we're essentially assuming that backgrounds don't matter, and that the important thing is just to see enough events that you can establish that something funny is going on. So you might think, for instance, that something like this might kind of look like a photon that converts to two electrons somewhere in the material. But actually, when that happens, they tend to be very close together. So these angular cuts, that you have two very high-energy things that are happening at wide separation with time delays and with displaced vertices, is just not something the standard model really fakes. So maybe another way of saying that is that the backgrounds tend to be instrumental. They're not physics backgrounds that you can just sort of sit down and think, okay, what does the standard model do that's going to look like this? And that means that we're not very good at figuring out what they are. It doesn't mean they don't exist. So that's something that experimentalists really have to figure out. But so this is just our best guess, that if you had five events that look like this, they're weird enough that you wouldn't be able to explain them otherwise, and you would start to think that you're seeing something new. Of course, there's a lot that would have to be done after that to really establish what's going on. But so in this scenario, I've plotted in the Gluino and Swart mass plane contours for discovery potential. You can see they sort of depend on the lifetime. If the lifetime is 100 millimeters, you get this curve. As the lifetime gets longer, you sort of go out to here, and you're doing even better. But then as the lifetime gets too long, you're not doing so well again, and the curve sort of sweeps back down to here, which is 10 meters. But basically, you're probing, depending on exactly where you sit here, you're probing something like 600 GeV squarks or 500 GeV gluinos, things in this sort of range.
If you double that to, let's say, 10 events for discovery, how does this change?
It shouldn't change a lot because the cross section is falling pretty fast. I'm not sure exactly how far these curves would move. But
something like out of fact, like group 2 or something like that.
That's plausible.
It
wouldn't be a lot. I mean,
yeah, the sort of length expectation would be more like the 1/5 or 1/6 power because that's roughly what the cross section is. 4/6 power, but that's what the cross section is.
Yeah, that's right. The proton luminosities are falling really fast.
So, yeah, so not much at all.
Yeah.
Not much at all. Okay, so here's another plot. Here I've only plotted the Gluino mass here. The squarks are fixed at 1 TeV. And these are contours with number of events you would expect as a function of lifetime and Gluino mass. So one interesting feature of this plot is you can see there's this region where increasing the Gluino mass doesn't really change the answer. So that's showing that you're getting sensitive to electroweak production in this region, and you don't actually need the strong production to start seeing something on the order of 5 to 10 events. And that's in the neighborhood of a couple meters for the decay lifetime. I guess I should mention that these curves are sort of adding up all the different things I told you about before, using the silicon, using the tracking chamber, using the muon system, and using decays to jets in the muon system with the hidden valley trigger. So here are acceptances for each of these. So this is the fraction of all the events that you would pick up with the set of cuts that I told you about using different detector systems, the pixel, the TRT, which is the main part of the tracker, the muon system, and then decays to jets. The curve for decays to jets has been artificially magnified by the branching fraction to jets over electrons. So your actual acceptance isn't that high, but you get more of the events because the branching fraction of z to jets is bigger, so the curve sticks out more. And the jets is the one that's farthest out because, remember, that's the one that lets you get decays that happen inside the muon system, not just before the muon system, as long as they're sort of before the middle of the muon system. So you can see that you're picking up a reasonable fraction of the events, a few percent of the events, sort of all the way from a 1/10 of a millimeter to something like 10 to the 5 millimeters, so that's 100 meters. And because you have all these different detector subsystems, you sort of cover the whole range and your acceptance never falls too low in the middle of this region. So you're really doing pretty well over several orders of magnitude in lifetime. But again, all I was telling you there was how to sort of do the minimal thing and see that these events look weird, see that they don't look like they're prompt, and start to establish that you have a signal. Once you do that, you really want to try to do more detailed measurements. And it turns out that for parts of this, like this jet signal, I'm not sure that it's possible to do the measurements that accurately. But for most of this, for a lot of this range, you can do much more because the ECAL at Atlas is very sophisticated and can do timing measurements and pointing measurements. Also, if the decays are too prompt, you might be able to establish with the pixels that they're displaced. But they're not displaced enough that you get enough of a time delay to be sensitive on the scales that you're measuring the time. So you can't really reconstruct things very well somewhere at the low end of this. But in the middle of this region, you can do very accurate reconstruction. And now I want to tell you how that works. So the Atlas ECAL can measure, as I mentioned earlier, the direction that something is moving as it passes through the ECAL. And the reason is that it has this longitudinal segmentation. It has many layers. And you can sort of see which layers are picking up energy and connect the dots and make some measurement of the angle. And the resolution you get on the angle is about 0.06 over the square root of e. So it's pretty precise. It degrades depending on where the thing comes from. So something that's sort of coming from an angle that's too distorted will not be measured very well, just because this isn't really what this was sort of designed to do. It might actually be possible for them to improve it if they work on it. But But basically, you start at 0.06 and you go up to something like 0.1 over the square root of e. If what I'm calling the effective z vertex is too big. Right, so here I have a more detailed plot of that. So the idea is that if you draw this sort of picture of the angle that the thing seems to be moving in when it passes through the layers of your ecal, and you extrapolate it back to the beam line, and here we've sort of projected onto this plane where we've rotated and put the place where we see the energy deposit at the top, then you measure some effective z-vertex. The thing looks like it came from here and went straight up. And that effective z-vertex can't be too big. Here you can see that when it's sort of of order 120 centimeters, 100 to 140 centimeters, the curve starts turning up and your resolution is getting much worse. So past that point, we don't use it. But we use anything that comes in at an angle where when you extrapolate back in this way, the effective z-vertex is below 100 centimeters. So the total number of things you can measure with the ECAL, or the energy, which you measure very accurately, the position where it hits in eta and phi, which again you measure very accurately, the direction in theta, which I just told you about, and the arrival time relative to the time that something would take if it came promptly from the interaction point, which the Atlas documents claim can be measured with a precision of 100 picoseconds. That's been tested to some extent with, as far as I know, not with early data since the LHC has been running, but with earlier beam tests where they just sort of shot a beam at one of their ECAL systems and studied its response. I've heard from some Atlas people that I shouldn't quite believe that 100 picoseconds number because it's difficult to calibrate. But at this point, I think that's what their documents say, that's what I'm going to use, and we'll see how they do. So this is measured just with the electromagnetic calorimeter. I haven't even used the tracker. And to reconstruct the decay that I'm interested in, so I have an NLSP, it decays to a Z, which goes to E plus E minus and a gravitino. I really have 10 unknowns. I have the 3 momentum, the direction of each of the E plus and E minus, and I have the 4 coordinates, 3 space, 1 time, for the decay vertex. So you can see that I have 10 unknowns. I have 10 measurements because I have these 5 measurements for each of my 2 electrons, my E plus and E minus. And so I can just solve. First, I can solve for the vertex location and time. My pointing gives me 2 quantities that look something like this. That's sort of the theta angle, which is direction in Z relative to direction in the XY plane. And then the timing gives me some constraint on the total distance from between the decay vertex and the point where I measured the energy. And so I have these 2 equations, 1 for each of the electrons, so that's 4 equations. I have 4 unknowns, and I can solve for it. I usually get multiple solutions, but only one of them is any good because the others either have the things decaying before they arrived or they have something moving at a speed bigger than the speed of light.
So since you're actually doing so circle, can you also use, for example, the angular information to really infer that it is a gravitino, you know, the LSP, which leads to the vector, or...?
You can't, there are 2 things you might like to infer about the gravitino, neither one of which I know how to do. So one of them is that you might like to know that it's effectively massless compared to everything else. I don't know how to do that. I think it's achievable with enough data, but I haven't thought it through. The other is that you would like to know that it's spin 3 halves, and I think that's really just impossible, because you're only really sensitive to the non-Goldstino part of the gravitino, the spin 3 halves part, if its mass is large enough relative to the energy scales that you're measuring. So if it were a GeV, you would be able to do that measurement. But if it were a GeV, the lifetime would be so long that you would never see this decay. And if it's an EV, the ratio is just too small. You're looking for a really tiny effect, and you just can't see it. So spin 3 halves, I think, is really impossible. Effectively massless, I think, is possible, but I haven't totally thought it through yet.
So in the end, you cannot say then if you're measuring the supersymmetry scale.
You cannot say that, as far as I know. Yeah, which is disappointing, but it's just a fact. I think you just can never have enough precision to see the spin 3 halves nature of it. Okay. Right. So with this, you can see that using only the ECAL, you can solve for the decay location. Once you know the decay location, you can also figure out the 3 momenta by figuring out just the direction between those and where you saw the energy deposit. If you assume the gravitino is massless, as I was just saying, I don't know how to substantiate that assumption, but if you make that assumption, you know the velocity because you know the decay location and time the neutralino had. you know, the momenta of both the E plus and E minus, and you can solve this equation for the unknown energy of the neutralino. And once you do that, you can also compute its mass. So then if you, these are just a couple of different points, one with a lighter NLSP, one with a heavier NLSP. These are both with, let's see, these plots are with 10 inverse femtobarns of data at 14 TeV, so this is assuming a few years down the road. And this is using only the ECAL. The lifetime here was 1 nanosecond, so a foot or 0.3 meters, if you prefer. And you can see that you can reconstruct the mass pretty well, but the distribution is pretty broad. There are a lot of these where you don't reconstruct it very well. And that's because you had 10 unknowns and you measure 10 things, so you're really sort of exactly constrained. And if you make an error on the measurement, it hurts a lot. But that's not using the tracker. So we can also use the tracker. The central part of the tracker at ATLAS is called the barrel TRT, and it measures the direction in the R5 plane. So that's the plane that sort of slices through it this way, not the plane along the Z-axis. And the default tracking algorithms won't find these tracks. I don't think I have time to talk about this in much detail, but there is an algorithm that looks for photons that convert, which is based on outside-in tracking. So it starts where you have an energy deposit in the calorimeter, and it looks back. But it assumes that things point back to the interaction point, because when a photon converts, the electrons that come out are going in pretty much the same direction. That's an assumption that we can't make. But we can make other assumptions. We can still use some sort of outside-in tracking, and we know that these things are pretty energetic, so the tracks are almost straight, which is another useful thing that you can throw into your algorithm to simplify things. There's a method they use in tracking in these track reconstruction algorithms called the Huff transform, which from talking to some people at ATLAS, it sounds like it would probably work in the setup. So finding these tracks is not automatic, but you can do it if you look for them. And so to recap, the things that you measure are these five quantities at the ECAL, energy, location, direction, and theta, and time. And the TRT, I'm assuming that you can dig out these tracks. It really needs to be studied by tracking experts at ATLAS, but it seems possible. And the estimate is that it would be measured with 1 milliradian precision in the phi direction. So once you have that, these were 10 quantities to solve for 10 unknowns. Now you can throw in the phi direction of each of the two tracks. So you have 12 quantities that you measure, 10 unknowns, and you're over-constrained. And that helps you beat some of the problems before where this distribution was really washed out because of errors in your measurements. I haven't talked in as much detail about the muon system, but it turns out you can do very similar things. You measure the momentum. You can measure the direction because you have many layers of the muon system, and some of them measure direction in theta, some measure it in phi. So overall, the precision you get in both of those is something like 15 milliradians. You can measure the time when it hits the muon system with a 2 nanosecond precision, so that's a lot worse than you did with the ECAL. But on the other hand, the muon system is a lot further out, so it's not so bad. You're looking at things with longer lifetimes anyway when you look at the muon system. And of course, you also measure the location, which I didn't write here. So you're basically doing comparably well if you either use the ECAL plus the TRT, or you use just the muon spectrometer. So here's the results with ECAL plus TRT. The gray histogram in the background is the one I showed you before, which was using only what the ECAL can measure. Once I throw in the tracking information, you can see the peak gets much narrower, and the fit is much better. So you really have a very clean measurement. You reconstruct these events really well. And let's see, I don't have the plot for the muon system, but it's comparable. Just at longer lifetimes. This was 0.3 meters. If you go out to something like 10 meters, then the muon system does much better, and it gives you a fit that's very comparable to that. Okay, so earlier I showed you some acceptance plot that was just establishing that you had something that was displaced, and it went from all the way from 0.1 millimeters out to something like 100 meters. If you use the techniques that I'm telling you about now, and you really want to reconstruct things very well, you're more limited, but you still cover a few orders of magnitude. You cover from something like 0.01 meters out to 100 meters. And so the blue dotted curve here is the geometric acceptance for, let's see. Right, the blue dotted curve is the geometric acceptance for being able to use the ECAL and TRT to reconstruct something. Some of those, when you try to reconstruct them, you just get a fit that's terrible and you have to throw them out. And when you take that into account, you get some efficiency, which is the purple curve. And you can see you don't lose much from bad reconstruction. In the muon system, you lose a bit more from bad reconstruction. I guess just because some of your resolutions are worse over some range, so you don't do quite as well. But the screen curve is the final result from the muon system. So you can see it takes over, actually, even a bit before a meter, you get better acceptance with the muon system than with the ECAL and TRT. And overall, you cover out to something like 100 meters, maybe even 1,000 if you have enough rate and you can accumulate enough events. And since you've reconstructed the full decay, you know the momentum of all the different particles that are involved, you can really start to pin down the underlying physics. So here I'm measuring the invariant mass squared of the electron in the gravitino once I do the reconstruction. And if I had Higgsinos, then I would expect that they decay to longitudinally polarized Zs. And if I had Wienos, I would expect they decay to transversely polarized Zs. And that polarization information gets encoded in this invariant mass distribution because you can show that, in the rest frame of the Z, this is the angle between the gravitino direction and the electron direction, which turns out to be a good polarization analyzer. So you expect a distribution to be 1 minus cosine beta squared in this case and 1 plus in this case. And you can see that when you do the reconstruction, you get a reasonably good fit to those curves. So these dotted lines are just the pure curves for 1 minus and 1 plus. And then the histograms are what you actually measure. So the measurement isn't perfect, but it's good enough that you can resolve the difference between these. And it's a significant difference. This is using just inverse spintop runs of data at 14 TeV. At a point where the gluino mass, this is going through production of a gluino, which has a mass of 600 GeV, if I remember correctly. Okay, another thing you would like to measure is the lifetime. That's actually a bit trickier because you don't have an exponential that's modified by both boosts and geometric effects. If things decay too promptly, then you can't tell that they're displaced and you're not able to measure a lifetime. If they decay too late, then they're outside the detector system you're using. And so you have this distribution of, if you reconstruct the decay length using the procedure I just told you about, this is what the distribution might look like. You can see there's not a lot of remnant of some exponentially falling thing. There's just some shape like this. And the places that it gets cut off are sort of geometric, so they don't depend too much on the underlying lifetime. But if you fit this, if you simulate it and fit it, you can reconstruct the lifetime pretty well. But of course, because this depended on the boosts of the things that you produced, it needs to know the gluino mass, which I'm assuming you were able to measure. So this really hinges on how well you're able to do that measurement, and that's something that we haven't studied yet. Okay, so I've been telling you about decays to electrons or to muons. I told you a bit about using jets for discovery in the muon system, but not for reconstruction. You might wonder if you can use jets for reconstruction because Z to jets happens much more often than Z to electrons. Jets do leave some fraction of their energy in the ECAL, so you might hope that you can still use a time that you measure in the ECAL. And pointing would be more difficult. You would have a lot more tracks coming out, and so it might be a little bit more difficult to reconstruct them. And then there are trigger issues. One thing you might be able to trigger on are calorimeter deposits of energy that come from a jet where you don't find tracks pointing at it because the decay came so late that the standard tracking algorithms don't find the tracks. So that's something that doesn't happen very often. Hidden Valley, some of the Hidden Valley people have discussed using a trigger like that. So this is something that might be possible, but it seems difficult, and it's probably better to focus on the thing that has a small branching fraction, but that's clean enough that you understand how to study it. Okay, so I've only been telling you about Atlas. You might ask, what about CMS? It's pretty comparable. It's a bit smaller, so at longer lifetimes, you just have less reach just because of the geometric size of the detector. You have something like 1 nanosecond timing for muons, 100 picosecond for the ECAL, so that's very comparable to what Atlas had. What it doesn't do so well is measure whether photons are non-pointing, measure this theta direction at the ECAL. And the reason is that CMS's ECAL is sort of big crystals, and it's not as easy to sort of pick out the amount of energy in different layers and reconstruct something. But there has been a little bit of work on this. You can see they sort of use the amount of energy that falls in different cells. If it really came directly from your action point, it's sort of almost all in one cell. In this case, it's a bit distributed. But they don't necessarily need this because they have 3D tracking. They have layers inside their tracking system which are able to measure direction in both phi and theta, which Atlas doesn't have beyond the silicon layers. So we haven't worked out any detailed results for CMS, but we think they can do something comparable. I only have a minute or so left, but one thing I've been talking about recently with people at Rutgers, with Matt Strassler and Gary Gerstein, is what happens if you have a sample of events where you see two energy deposits in the ECAL? Initially, you would think they're photons, but they might actually be electrons that just came from a late decay, so you don't see the track. Is there a simple way to sort of start diagnosing what this is before you go through all the work of the things I've been telling you about digging out tracks and doing the full reconstruction? Are there simple distributions you can plot from the beginning that give you some hint of what's going on? And so just one preliminary example of that, if you just pretend that these energy deposits came from the origin, you can compute an invariant mass for them. And what you see is that if they came from something that decayed, like my neutralino that decays to Z plus gravitino, the actual angle between these two electron tracks is much bigger than what you would think is the angle if you're treating them as if they came from the origin. And that tends to push the invariant mass down to smaller values. So you see you get a curve that sort of roughly peaks around the Z mass and then has a long tail to lower values. Similarly, if this was something like a Higgs, of course the Higgs has a short lifetime, but if you imagine some other resonance that decayed directly to these two objects, you get a curve which is sort of similar but doesn't seem to have as much of a tail at longer values. And if these were totally independent, like in minimal gauge mediation, where on each side of the event you might have a beano that decays to photon and gravitino, then you get some shape which has a long tail to high values and no interesting edge like these two just seem to have. So this is just one of the first distributions you might look at, and then obviously in this case you might expect them more often to be separated by big angles. So you could do 2D plots of this mass against delta R. There are lots of things to play with, and we're just beginning, but it looks like it might make it more palatable to the experimentalist to start pursuing these if you sort of lead them through a set of steps where they start with very easy things to measure and then progressively convince themselves that this might be the scenario, and once you're convinced of that, then you might be more willing to do the work of really digging out these tracks and doing the careful measurement. And there's a little bit of a prospect for D0 to improve an existing search and set some limit in a small part of parameter space, but the LHC is really rapidly taking over here. Okay, so just to conclude, at this point, general neutralino NLSPs are relatively unconstrained. What's constrained is mostly just minimal gauge mediation. If you have something that's long-lived and it decays to a Z, you get extremely clean events with displaced electrons, and there's a possibility for early discovery over a wide range of lifetimes. With more data, you could do very clean kinematic reconstruction, and you can really start to learn about the underlying physics. And I think the next few years will be exciting, and I'm looking forward to seeing the LHC results. Thank you. Yeah.
We don't know what energy your supersymmetry is for.
We don't know
what energy plays a 30 on us. It has a supersymmetry breaking at 10 to the 70 EV. What happens?
If it's 10 to the 70 EV, you might hope that there's a small fraction of the events that decay soon enough that you might see them, but you're definitely on the, I mean, to go back to this plot, you can see that there's some tail on the acceptance curve, right? So some fraction of the events is still, about how to translate 10 to the 70 EV. Actually, 10 to the 70.
I'm just throwing out a number.
Yeah. 10 to the 70 EV would be somewhere on the tail. So you might still have a small fraction. And if you took enough data, you might see it. If
it could be the Planck energy.
At a certain point like that, it's just totally out of reach. And that's all I can say. Yeah.
So you also check on the scenario is cosmologically sound?
That's definitely an issue. So these are gravitino masses sort of in the EV, 10 EV range. Some of them are light enough that I think there's no problem. Others you would definitely have to worry about the cosmology.
You mean because of the contribution to the dark matter?
Yeah. Yeah, these decays are all prompt enough that you don't worry about late decays screwing things up, but just the relic abundance is an issue.
Yeah, and would you generically have expected the neutral Eno that produced them to have overclosed the universe in the first place? Because only then could you have...
I think it's actually the thermal production also, because if you have a very light relic Eno, then you can... I mean, if the really temperature of the universe is too high, then you produce too many of them. But if you make the gravitino very light, then the Goldstein mode couples so strongly that they eventually get into thermal equilibrium, and then you have a thermal gravitino abundance, and then you are fine again. So if you decrease in gravitino mass sufficiently, then you're fine, but there might be a mass range.
Yeah, so part of this is within the range where you're fine by that standard. Part of it, I think, isn't. I haven't gone through this carefully. I mean, certainly, if you see a signal on a collider, then one of the most important things to think about will be how to correlate it with what we know about cosmology. And I haven't thought that through very much.
How do you decide that if you see the neutral Eno, how do you decide that it's stable? It has to be to produce a galaxy halo.
Well, the neutral Eno here is not stable because it's decaying down to the gravitino and something else. The neutral Eno here is not stable because it's decaying to the gravitino.
Yeah, I know.
The gravitino.
You're supposed to be looking for dark matter.
Well, in this case, the neutral Eno would not be dark matter.
No, this is not dark matter.
There might be some small window here where the gravitino could be dark matter, but in general, I think if you see gauge mediation, you expect that the dark matter is something totally different. It might be some pseudo-modulus, it might be a baryon from some other sector. I mean,
this whole thing is obviously not
talking. This isn't the scenario where neutral Enos are dark matter.
What is the scenario? People look for dark matter, according to the New York Times.
Yeah, so if supersymmetry is broken at a much higher scale and you have gravity mediation and not gauge mediation, your neutral Eno tends to be at the bottom of the spectrum and it doesn't decay to anything else. And that's the case where it's... it can be dark matter.
All right, let's speak again. And Matthew will be around for a bit.